Welcome back to the Autistic Tidbits and Tangents podcast. I'm Kara Diamond. I'm one of your hosts. I'm an autistic university lecturer and teacher from Toronto, Canada. And with me, I have my co-host, Bruce. Bruce, do you want to say a few
words? Hello, everybody. Yeah, here's a few words. Pink elephant. How about that? Hi, everybody. My name is Bruce Petherick. My day job is Autistic Advocate for Autism Canada. I am coming to you from Vancouver, British Columbia. And before I worked for Autism Canada, I was a professional musician for years. I think it's 45 now, which makes me feel very, 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 very old.
No comment. With us today, we have Kristen Hovett. And Kristen is a late diagnosed autistic individual from Williston, North Dakota, and currently based in Kelowna, British Columbia, so not too far from Bruce. And about a year after her late diagnosis, she started The Other Autism, which first began as a private Facebook group, and then blog posts and articles, and finally a podcast by the same name, which she continues to write, produce, and host. And I should mention, it is also up for some awards. The Other Autism podcast explores late autism diagnosis and the latest in autism research and works to challenge myths and stereotypes about autism and autistic people. She also works as a full-time research communications specialist for BC Children's Hospital Research Institute and will soon have a Master's of Health Studies degree with a focus on health research and policy. She gives presentations and guest lectures about a variety of autism-related subjects, and in her spare time, she loves going to concerts, reading, traveling, and working out. And her favorite places she's lucky to have visited include Namibia, Japan, and the Galapagos Islands. She recently started producing electronic music, which we will also ask her about, which can be found on Spotify, Apple Music, and other music streaming platforms, and we will link to them at the end of the episode. So today we are going to talk about so many fascinating things about Kristen and Kristen's passions, but we also want to talk about medical advocacy when it comes to us autistic people.
Thanks for having me. Sorry for making the bio so long.
Oh no, it's okay.
Welcome to Autistic Tidbits and Tangents.
Candid conversations between autistic off-hour professionals.
Cool.
Trigger warnings for this episode include discussions of the medical field and being autistic, navigating that field, medical language, disability, and what it means to be disabled, experiences of marginalized communities and the medical system and the diagnostic process. So welcome, Kristen. It's so great to have you here, and you, another podcaster.
To be here.
What inspired you to create your podcast?
I think I just really like the medium. I really got into it myself as a listener. I kind of experimented with it a few years ago, and that didn't really go anywhere, but it was always in the back of my head to try again. And so when I had the opportunity, I got a microphone and I just decided to try again, and it's been great. It's kind of taken off unexpectedly. Wonderful. So yeah.
I should buy a microphone. My sound quality is not nearly as crisp as yours, but add that to the long list of technology I need to get. So you're really interested in research and things affecting the lives of autistic people. I want to pick your brain about like nerdy things. Do you have any recent research that has sort of fired your neurons, gotten you really excited, anything or enraged? I think we experience those emotions a lot when we read research.
Let's see. I guess in terms of like language use, something that comes up a lot is people want to know about something called the female autism phenotype, which you may have heard about already. And for a lot of people, that's problematic. But unfortunately, that's the term that people still use, researchers still use. So I find myself having to use it, but always going, this can apply to people of any gender. So that's one that I keep seeing. Just the field of critical autism studies is really interesting. So if anyone hasn't looked into that, that's one I highly recommend in terms of the social sciences. Super interesting awesome. There as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't it? It's so funny. Like I'm starting to collect my favorite researchers, you know? Bruce.
Oh, genetic Ooh. Studies is one. I can't say too much about it just because I'm not sure how comfortable the researchers are with giving the information. But in terms of the researchers I'm thinking of looked at the views of autistic adults of genetic testing in the context of autism. So we have tons of research on the perspectives of caregivers, parents, and healthcare professionals, but we don't have the views and opinions and feelings of autistic adults. And so it was really fascinating to read that. And I'm writing an article for work right now about that. So
I can't wait to see that. I'll look out for it when it's out.
Yeah. It's funny how often I get criticized when I raise problematic ethical problems with genetic research and autism. People sort of go, well, why? It's like, well, are you considering what the research can do? I'm honestly on the I'm pro research in just anything, just academic and research and finding out more about the world. I'm great. But to be honest, if we never find a genetic marker for autism, I think I would be very comfortable. I'm too scared of what can happen.
Yeah, the potential for eugenics and things like that, for sure. Mm-hmm. I know what you mean. And just, the lens through which we are often positioned when we are subjects of research. So I love seeing, like you said, the new sort of critical autism studies where we have a lot of autistic researchers and autistic people partnering with researchers to design much more affirming work about our experiences and things that matter to us, as opposed to things that are an outside perspective of what should be good for us, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, for me, I'm a fan of genetics, but definitely I agree with Bruce. And I agree with the worries about, you know, what they call family planning and things like that. Euphemistically, I guess, because it is eugenics. But I guess for me, someone who has hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos and mast cell activation disorder, things that eventually they'll potentially have genetic testing for, that could be useful. So, you know, if they use, oh, you're autistic, then you should potentially be tested for that. I can see that being useful.
Very helpful, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there has to absolutely be consent. That's the number one concern. If a child's getting tested, they can't consent.
Mm-hmm. What a good problem. Point. Mm. And
it's difficult, isn't it? And Kristen, you're bringing up an interesting point that it's some of the comorbidities that genetic testing for your case, it's 100%. I'm completely okay and wonderful. And this could be really, really brilliant. It's the consent that you've raised, that's really super interesting. But it's also it's the ethics of what we do with testing. And it should be. I want to live in a world where we don't worry about that. That if we can have a test for autism and it's like, oh, you're autistic, and that's where it ends. Yeah. That's, I would be so happy with that. Sorry, I'm possibly on a rah, rah, rah rage right now.
We start off in tangents. It's great. Well, you raise a really good point, Kristen, too, about, you know, so many of us, of our people, have like connective tissue disorders, other, you know, physical disabilities, physical autoimmune conditions, things like that, which ties in with what we want to talk about, which is medical advocacy. Now, I know that you had shared with me that you are a cancer survivor. Is that the preferred term? Like what?
That's what I say. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just want to make sure. and I believe you found out before you were diagnosed as autistic.
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, as an autistic person, anyways, and you were navigating those challenges, did you notice anything in particular that had hospital staff understood you were autistic? Had you yourself understood you were autistic? Anything that could have made your experience easier?
Yeah, definitely. It's hard to go back because it was such an overwhelming time.
I bet.
And so obviously having no clue about autism, I was diagnosed with cancer about 4 years before the autism diagnosis. So it was not even on my radar. So I wasn't even suspecting it at all. And so initially with the diagnosis, immediate burnout, I think I just went straight into burnout with all of the appointments, having to see different members of the oncology team and having to process the information with a partner who was not able to be super supportive. Mm. And so not even knowing how to advocate for myself, not even knowing that it was different in any way. I thought, this is what happens when you get a cancer diagnosis. Yeah. So I just have to deal with it, you know? So right from the start, I mean, you go in and there's bright lights, there's tons of people, you have to find where you're going, you have to meet new doctors, you know, and nurses. And so, yeah, it's just way too much information and you're trying to make decisions and navigate. Yeah. It's almost impossible. I felt almost just pulled along through the journey as opposed to making decisions, advocating, things like that. That makes sense.
And of course it makes sense. And so much of it is like an executive functioning nightmare. If you have any executive dysfunction, because keeping up with all the appointments and the times and where you have to be and making phone calls, there's so many potential barriers.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when I was told things, details about what was going on with me and how the treatment would look, I think my response was often just to go blank, just to go, nod and stare. That was pretty much my entire, experience in terms of my response. And so I think the doctors were just confused and just kept feeding information, right? And I didn't know what else to do. So. Yeah, it was an interesting time for sure.
That reminds me. So I when I was 31, I had a lump in my breast that I had to get removed because they weren't sure what it was after biopsying it. And I feel like I didn't react how they expected some of the time. They would give me news and put a Kleenex box in front of me. And I'd be like, no, just tell me the facts. And that's another part of, doctors' expectations of how we are supposed to react can probably impact the care that we receive or even the information that they give us. I don't know if that's something, Bruce, can you make any connections to this?
Definitely. I have a parallel story, but mine's from a mental perspective. So for a short period, about 15 years ago, I was committed to a psychiatric part of a hospital for a short time. I was there for 3 or 4 days. And now I see it. What happened was a burnout, an autistic burnout. And I think what made me disappointed in the, in perspective now, and sort of disappointment with what you've had to go through, Kristen, is that I was in a psych ward, and no one, this is years before my diagnosis, no one discussed or even thought about that I might have been autistic, and how that experience would have been so much different if they had considered that as an option. And it's something I hear, too many times, both from work and also even friends back in Australia, of people navigating the medical system and their differences, their neurological differences being ignored. Mm-hmm. And you think, these are the people that are supposed to know. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And compounding those difficulties, you know, if they don't recognize it, if we are in environments that are overloading our senses, Kristen, you already mentioned the lights and the sounds, and I think we're also overloaded by unpredictability. And when you are in medical settings, you don't know what's going to happen or when or how long you'll have to wait, and all of that just makes it so much more difficult to be taken care of and get our needs met.
Definitely.
And you sort of work in this field, so do you have any tips or thoughts on how we can improve things for autistic people who have to go through medical appointments and advocate for themselves or figure out how to advocate for themselves?
Well, I was going to mention too, just for me, and I think this is true of a lot of autistic folks, is that a lot of us have medical trauma. We have a history of medical trauma, whether it's physical health, mental health. And so for me, that was triggered right from the start. Mm-hmm. So if they're not able to recognize signs of PTSD, signs of neurodivergence, that's a problem. And so I think that needs to be taught. That needs to be almost like medical school 101. You know, if you have responses that are unexpected to you as a physician, as a nurse, whatever that may be, you need to be on the lookout for that, especially when we know just how common late diagnosis is and how many people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s are getting diagnosed now. So it's almost like everyone has to be on the lookout for that. Because, you know, things like for me that compacted the medical trauma that I'm still working through today,
wow,
how many years after, right, is like there were so many things that I could have taken in, I guess, advantage of basically as a patient, like psychological treatment. Like I basically could have gone from radiation to counseling. But because of the factors that I mentioned, like the overwhelm, the sensory issues, the having to navigate and already being completely burnt out and overwhelmed in my life in general at that point, yeah, I didn't take advantage of that. Plus I had, you know, gut related symptoms based on, because of the type of treatment I had, which was all three types, like, so surgery, major surgery, 25 rounds of radiation and 5 rounds of cisplatin chemo. So I definitely could have used the psychological intervention, but I just wanted to get the heck out of there after every single appointment. And if I had had someone there to advocate for me or something like that, had I even known what was happening, you know, I could have taken advantage of it there and saved myself so many issues afterwards, where now it's like years later and I'm still working through this piece by piece, right?
So an advocate, especially being something important. And I think that's good for most people too, going into, especially if it's, you're seeing a specialist, if there is some sort of diagnostic information relayed, like you said, you can freeze, you can sort of go blank, and having someone mm-hmm. who can take the notes or ask some of the questions that maybe you don't think to ask in that moment.
Or being able to record it just on our phones, you know, I know that could be an issue and some will be like, oh, I don't really want myself recorded, but it's like, I desperately need this. Like, I think some physicians will understand and I think it could become a norm. Right.
Yeah. I love that idea. Cause processing delays too. Like mm-hmm. we need to be able to replay what they've told us so we don't miss anything.
And I think because of the sort of like blankness that we can experience, it looks like we're not processing. It looks like the very opposite, but we're more deeply processing. And that's why you're seeing what you're seeing, right? So it's like, don't stop talking to us. We're still listening. We just need more time.
Yeah.
So
Actually, for me, because I went through a fair whack of medical training, when I get a multiple diagnosis, all I'm doing is focusing on what the first point was. And in my head, going back through university like 40 years ago and all the research, and I've not listened to the next two or three points because I'm hyper-focused on what was an interest. Uh-huh. It's interesting that this sort of, how do I put this? And I've just gone through this with my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law had multiple conditions. She hasn't been a well woman for many, many years. And when she would go to, especially when she would go to hospital, they would tell her four or five things. And she couldn't take any of them in. And even when she was taking my sister-in-law, there was this constant, kind of write this down. And it's like, why is that not just a standard practice that when you're getting, this is what we've done all this research, we've done this, these tests, and here are the five things we think you've got. Why can't that be written down? Like, I know the doctor's reading from it.
Yeah.
No, I agree. And it just seems so dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, you mishear something, or you think, I'm going to do these four things, and you forget step one, but you do step two, three, and four. But step two and three, four are useless because you didn't do step one. Like, it just becomes dangerous.
And I'm certainly not maligning doctors. I have such a respect for medical professionals, and but they have lots of patients. They sometimes rush appointments. Like, you don't always get the time to process, to ask things, to express related concerns you might have. You know, if the doctor doesn't ask you the right question, especially as an autistic person, we can be literal in how we answer questions. We might not give them information that could be relevant if they don't ask the right questions.
Right. And give us the option to maybe write our thoughts or questions. Like, for me at that time, I don't think I could have articulated my questions, honestly. I was just so overwhelmed and so in pain in so many ways that I can't formulate a question right now.
You almost want to have like a phone follow-up a day or two later so that you have time to process and come back with, okay, well, these were the questions that I had that didn't come into my brain until the next day.
For sure.
That would be definitely ideal world.
My wife writes down what I need to say. Like, if I'm going to a doctor's appointment and let's say it's something, you know, big, she'll talk to me over the week or two before and say, make sure you tell the doctor, and she'll write them down. So I actually go prepared with what I'm saying, because there's been situations for me where I'll go in with, you know, my arms falling off. Are you in pain? Like, right that second, no. So I go, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But for the last 10 days, I haven't been able to move my arm. Just right now, it seems to be kind of okay. You know, I'm fine, you know.
Well, and then pain rating, like when you have to rate your pain from 0 to 10, I don't know. I just know that in this moment, I'm in pain. I can't give you like qualifiers. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
I mean, we get this, you and I have talked about this all the time, of like how difficult it is for us to judge that scale of, you know, how friendly am I being right now on a scale of 0 to 10? It's either 10 or zero, like something in the middle.
It's so hard to gauge those things.
Yeah, definitely.
So I guess like there's sort of a two-pronged approach, how we advocate for ourselves and then what medical professionals need to understand better to helping us in these settings. Kristen, so
two very big questions.
So I guess tackle them one by one. As autistic people, what do you think are the things that we can do to be proactive and advocate for our own needs in healthcare?
I think continuing to speak about it like this, and also, I guess, just bringing it up, becoming patient partners, getting involved in research. I think that's the best, that because I think doctors want to hear. It's just the avenues to make that happen just aren't there yet in the ways that they should be. But if we continue to speak about it and make sure that we remember that it's important, we might have heard this before, but it's like the more voices we can add, I think that's going to be the most helpful in making change.
Mm-hmm. So, Bruce, do you have any thoughts?
No, I think that's a really, really good answer. I'm scared of the second question about how we help doctors' education, because that's a minefield.
It's a huge one. And then part of that too is how do we bring alternative communication in, because, you know, I mean, we've all sort of articulated sometimes having difficulty speaking in these settings ourselves. And then we have other autistics who are non-speakers or semi-speaking. And again, there are issues with efficiency and speed, and you have to wait longer to hear people speak when they're typing. So speak was in quotation marks. Do you think that's somewhere we're moving? Do you think that there is potential for getting doctors and other medical professionals to understand how important it is to have wait time, allow assistive technology and things like that into appointments?
I think some might be getting it, depending on the department.
That makes sense.
I also know, like, even with my cancer follow-ups, I had follow-ups for quite a long time. First, it was every month, then 3 months, then 6 months. And they would give me this iPad to, like, fill out a questionnaire. So it was a mental health questionnaire that I usually lied on because I didn't want to stay later. This is another aspect of an issue. Because same with the mental health support that I spoke of earlier. It's like, if I make it known that I'm like depressed or anxious, they're just going to keep me here longer and I don't want to stay at BC Cancer, right? Yeah. So it's all kinds of triggering. I would get nauseous and headaches. It was awful. Anyway, what I was saying about the iPad or the tablet is that they could use that for so many other things, like have a sort of area where you can kind of freeform your thoughts and not be multiple choice, mm-hmm. right? Because I had so much time of just sitting there in the waiting area with this tablet. You know, I'm like, I could be filling out an essay right now, like how I really feel and what I'm really thinking. And so they already have the technology. If they just use it slightly differently,
that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Cara, when you brought this up, I suddenly had this brilliant thought that every autistic person should take an AAC device in to a certain, and like make them wait.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Make them, you know, I mean, it's a little sledgehammer to crack a walnut problem, but I suddenly thought that would be kind of quite subversive, actually.
Mm-hmm. But would they wait?
Raising the point.
well, you know what? Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to say, like, with what I noticed having lots of medical issues over the years, is like when you have a specialist, they tend to have more time for you. And so in those scenarios, you know, I have a lot more time than just 10, 15 minutes like I would with a clinic doctor or something. So they definitely have time to read or wait and listen as you formulate something. So.
And I wonder if that's something that before going into the appointment, like when the appointment is booked, you know, communicating somehow in advance, like this is a requirement that I have for my communication needs. So there may be more time required. Like, is that something that we can advocate for when our appointments are booked? I don't know.
Yeah. And I think they're doing that. Like, I'm thinking of like trans care clinics where they already know the high overlap with, you know, being trans and being autistic. Mm-hmm. And so they've made changes because of that. They know they're going to have tons of autistic people come in. And so they've made changes in how they talk to their clients. And so those can be adopted, I think, in many different scenarios.
Oh, I love that. Mm. That's a great piece of knowledge to have. I hadn't considered that before. Mm. Yeah.
There is a fundamental problem with our discussion of this, is that, I mean, I think, Cara, you said before, your respect for doctors. And obviously, since I started on the path, that's also my condition as well. It's the...
Neoliberalism? Is that where we're going?
It is. That's exactly where it's going. And I mean, it kind of is the problem. It's like, I think, I know every single doctor in the world does want to spend more time with patients who need it. And I also know there's a lot of patients who really do need the 10 minutes, the 5 minutes, and that's all. That's fine. That's great. But it's like, that's the problem. Our system is so structured that it's got to be a 15-minute appointment. And look, I got to be honest, my I want to say family doctor. I used to go to when I was living in Calgary, I went to a university clinic. I shan't say which one because otherwise people will want to use it. It's where I used to teach. And the doctor knew me because I had a relationship with her for 15 years. So I never spent 15 minutes. It was always half an hour. And she learned to ask the questions that she knew she had to drag the information out. Now, my medical care was brilliant. I mean, she saved my life at least once. And I just wanted else to have that same access to that type of treatment. When you need to talk to a doctor for longer than 15 minutes, that it can happen. And, you know, Kristen, your point about trans clinic is like somebody going through a transition like that, you can't put a time limit on it. Mm-hmm. But you probably shouldn't put a time limit on an oncology call, but you know.
Definitely not.
For sure.
Yeah. So neoliberalism. Yeah. Boom, boom, boom. Smash the stage.
We almost always go back to that, Kristen. Okay. Rant about that. So we'll try to keep that contained for today. But and Bruce, I'm sorry, I'm just going back to what you said many points earlier too about coming in with a list. And that's like a strategy that I use. I will write down all the things that I should mention in case they're important. And like, I will read the whole thing. Like I mean, my doctor knows and loves me, thank goodness. Incidentally, his name is Dr. Kara. And so when I got my PhD, like he must think I'm so obnoxious, but I'll be like, from one Dr. Kara to another. We have a good relationship, but I will say, like, I'm just going to read off everything that I've noticed. And if it's important, now you have the information. So I kind of info dump anything that I think has changed or is noteworthy.
Nice.
A good thing for us to do.
Other thing I was thinking if I could mention is like, also, I think in terms of just, this is going to take a long time and it's not going to happen overnight, but I guess autistic people getting more comfortable disclosing with their medical providers. I think I know for some, it's just not possible. But for those who are on the fence, like if you can't disclose, if you can get to the place of being comfortable, I recommend doing it because so often I still see doctors and they're like, oh, you don't look autistic, you know? And so that response is going to start to go to, you know, decrease the more and more we come out of the high maskers, come out the late diagnosed, right? And so they get used to that. They get used to like, oh, there's not a look. There's not an autistic look, right? So we might look like we're neurotypical, but we're not going to process like a neurotypical.
That's a great point. Yeah.
It goes back to your question, your comments about the female phenotype, which is like crazy in one respect to think that there is such a thing. I obviously hear the story like 10 times a day that somebody has had an interaction with somebody and they've got the response, you don't look autistic. And it's like, who invented a look of autism? Like, what does that even mean?
Mm-hmm. What does it
definitely
mean?
And ironically, there's so many people in the medical community who are autistic, diagnosed or not.
Yes.
Right? So that's the other piece of it.
We were talking the other day about the study of autistic doctors. And the language that they used in, so doctors who used autistic doctors as opposed to person, a doctor with autism had lower rates of suicidal ideation and suicidal attempts, which was interesting. Like it's correlation, not obviously causation, but it was an interesting piece to see doctors who saw other autistic doctors used identity first language tended to feel more attached to community, feel like that it's not a disorder, it's a difference, and what an impact that makes. So that's pretty incredible. And now we have to kind of spread that language to other people so they also understand it is a difference. It's a significant difference in how we process and the needs that we have. But, I hate when I've said, I'm autistic and people go, oh no, but you're smart or you don't look it or whatever it is. Like all of these things that are not mutually exclusive.
Right, exactly. And in the position I'm in with my podcast, and I guess just being so out there in the community, I get a lot of people disclosing to me and they're like, don't tell anyone else, you know, like, so that includes nurses, doctors, like therapists, psychologists. And I was thinking, you know, if you disclose to each other, you're going to have a community right there, ready-made that you don't even realize.
Exactly.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's so many benefits to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely.
I don't know if I've shared this on this podcast, but Kara, you know this very well, that one of the reasons that I got into advocacy was when I was teaching in schools. After my diagnosis, I was really happy just to share it. And every single class I said, I had kids come up to me saying, I'm also autistic or neurodivergent, but I haven't told anybody because there are no supports for me. And creating this community of having an autistic adult in the room with them mm-hmm. allowed them to feel much safer about diagnosing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people sort of say, oh, you're so courageous. And it's like, I just exist.
Yeah.
I'm just saying what I am, and I'm quite happy about it. And people have, you know, it's, I'm glad that people are getting something from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That the choice to disclose or not to disclose, like, and I think, obviously, it's easier for me in many ways as someone who's quite privileged to disclose and still have very little impact, I would say, very little negative impact in disclosing. But yeah, it was also didn't feel like a choice either, because it's like I have this information. I've never been one to be less than who I am, you know, or when I have been, I don't feel very easy about it. So it made sense. I teach autistic children, same kind of thing. I have to tell them, if I'm telling them being autistic is not a terrible thing, like I need to let them see that adults exist who are relatively happy and maybe not well-adjusted in my case, but working on it.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and you of course have a podcast as well where you're open about being autistic too. So what was that hard for you to do, or did you have a similar experience to Bruce and myself?
In terms of disclosing?
Yeah. Because it is such a journey.
I don't even recall. I think I was open to like everyone online before I was to people closest to me, if that makes sense. Like I was to like my mom and, you know, my partner, obviously, but yeah, it was a slow going process with friends and acquaintances and everyone else. And I think now everyone knows. I don't know what they all think, but I don't really care. I'm at a point where I don't care anymore. I don't know. So, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like sort of the coming out process is a lot easier online because you're talking to other autistic people going, oh, me too. You've had that happen. Oh, I thought that was just me. And all of these realizations that like you have these connections, you have people who have thought and felt and experienced things in a similar way. And you aren't this outlier. It's like, to me, that is such a beautiful part about disclosing your discovery about being autistic is we find out, wow, these are shared experiences, a lot of the things that we have.
Right. And I experienced, I guess, enough people to in the autistic community online who were very gentle with language usage, because I think a lot of people who are newly identified, they stumble with the language. So I was saying person with autism, I didn't realize at all the background. And I had a lot of people who are really gentle. And I think that helped me, because I think some people have experienced the opposite, where people kind of get down on them right away for the wrong language or saying the wrong thing. And that can make them kind of go backwards, you know, and start to not disclose. So I was lucky that way.
I learned that language story early. I was involved in a national documentary wearing a shirt that said Aspie, A-S-P-I-E. And I used to wear these shirts all the time. I used to love them. And the person who I did the interview with, did the documentary with, talked to me about 2 months later and said, you know, you should really look up the history of that word. I went, oh, is it a problem? She said, yeah, it's often used in an elitist way. And I kind of did the research and I haven't worn the shirt since. Mm-hmm. And but it was, I think, I very much the same way. It was gently pointed out to me, but actually it was gently pointed out, but also not saying, I think you should change. The question was, I think you should look into this. Mm-hmm. And it's a way I respond to language use as well. It's like, if you're using a language and you know the history and you know kind of what it means, like that's your choice, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to person first language. I'd prefer I'd certainly prefer not to use that. But if you are doing that with intention, that's your choice as an autistic person. Mm-hmm. Language is such a complicated.
And it's always evolving and how we use it. We have to keep up because things change so quickly and things can become euphemized and then we need new words for things. Like it happens all the time.
Well, even the word diagnosis now, I know for some that's also an issue because if we're moving away from the medical model of autism and into the social model, how does that look? Like, obviously, I think the preferred for a lot of people is I've been identified as autistic. Mm-hmm. It's a neurotype. Mm-hmm. But then we still have to recognize that there is this huge medical piece, right? And there are people that see themselves as disabled. Yeah. Being autistic, and we have to respect that too. So I find myself going back and forth between those two words.
Yeah. So. And I mean, intent matters. We say that a lot on this podcast. Yes. Is how mm-hmm. people say, because you can say autistic and make it sound like a dirty word, just like you can person with autism, right? Like either way, mm-hmm. it's how people say it.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, are you disabled? Kaboom, chick.
Big. Oh, geez. I don't know. I feel more, you know, disabled by the co-occurring conditions that I have, particularly in my case, mast cell activation, because I'm so limited in what I can eat. So that really impacts social situations. I guess I'm a more extroverted autistic person compared to other autistic people. I think when you compare me to like a lot of neurotypical people, I'd be introverted, but I like to go out. I like to do things, but I'm so limited by my medical condition. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I feel disabled. I feel disabled when I'm in an open concept office with bright fluorescent light that I can't think straight and I want to just punch the computer, you know, like I feel disabled in that environment. So it's very much where I am. Who's around me kind of thing.
It's a political thing.
No. Yeah, absolutely.
And certainly, you know, in my position at Autism Canada, I'm very open about saying I'm disabled, but I also make the point, it's a political comment. I'm disabled because the government tells me I am. And they give me some money because of that. So I'm, you know, I am disabled. But the truth is the disability is much more in those social barriers, exactly as you've just raised, the open concept office, the too loud music in the shopping center, they are very disabling for me in a crippling way. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's like, I don't feel disabled, but I'm quite happy to use that label because it's quite true. And actually, Kara, I've never asked you.
So there are certainly times, like when I am in extreme burnout, when my executive functioning is just not functioning the way I want it to, where I can't do anything that I would like to do. I can't help myself out of those situations. So I do find those aspects can be disabling. I have other like autoimmune things that I would, similar to what Kristen said, where I consider those debilitating and would definitely say, that those are disabilities. So I think for me, and we say this all the time as autistics too, like our functioning varies all the time. And there are certainly times where I'm severely impacted enough that I would be like, this is a disability. I am disabled. Is it all the time? No, because I also am well supported in most settings in my life. I have pretty good workarounds and support systems. And I avoid those places with the lighting and the really loud settings and the things that cause me to just shut down. So
it's quite interesting. No? Yeah. I was just thinking as you responded, since I've been like your friend when you're going through those things, I have never thought of you as being disabled. Like when it happens, when you're being overwhelmed or you can't function, or, you know, I canceled last week because just no spoons left. That wasn't disabled. That's just you. Mm. But I think so from an internal perspective and, you know, if I may say intimate from our friendship, it's like there's no disability there. It's just that's part of our being.
Yeah.
If I was outside, I think it's more apparent, the disability. And of course, what this is raising is that we are disabled for social reasons. We are disabled for physical communal reasons that are possibly unnecessary in a lot of the ways.
And as a high masking individual, like most people don't see that at all. Because I'm fortunate enough, usually when I'm like in a complete shutdown or meltdown, it's at home. Although I have to say, I work with a wonderful child and youth worker. She has definitely seen me in some difficult situations where I have had significant challenges, and she is just as wonderful with me as she is with the children in our care. So thank goodness for her and her support.
Totally. Yeah. For me, in work scenarios, I'll tend to do the shutdown mode. And even when people know about that I'm autistic, I don't think they immediately understand. And so they'll take it personally, maybe. I think that's, and so there's this like a lot of, I feel, repair that has to happen just in an unspoken way. Like I'm always making sure everyone's okay with me, you know? Exactly. So there's a lot of extra work and extra energy. I'm always depleted. Like that's just always a thing. If I'm going to have a job, that's just the way it is, unfortunately. So
why?
I know.
And trying not to give up. I mean, there's certain times at my workplace that I feel that perhaps to a lesser extent, but I work for a national autistic organization. You're working in a top children's hospital. Why is that expectation on us that for us to fix it, mm-hmm. or you to fix it in that situation?
I think it's always for me, like looking, like now it's a lot of doing retrospective, like looking back and how I was and just little things I do to make sure everyone's okay with me. Right. Yeah. And I'm just starting to realize all of that work. Like it's not being asked of me. It's almost like I'm doing it before anything can go wrong.
Yeah.
Right. And I have the accommodation. I can work from home.
Oh, nice.
So I rarely have to go in. That's why I'm able to be in Kelowna. And that has changed my life. Like, I don't think I could work as much as I do without that accommodation.
Oh, wow.
So, mm-hmm.
I was just thinking too, like, what was I thinking? I lost the thought. It'll come back to me.
Oh, no. What? On a tangent?
I know. What was it? We're talking about masking. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Just that the chronic extra work we are always doing, overthinking mm-hmm. things. How are we being perceived? How are we coming across? Are our intentions being received as the intentions we intend? What would that be like if we didn't have that? Can you imagine? Like, how would your life be different, Kristen?
I think just always burnt out, always frustrated, always like, yeah. Yeah.
That would be such a different world.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
Bruce is just smiling.
Well, I'm just smiling. I've just started to become a member of a community that's new. Yeah. I've just joined an orchestra. Well, I was asked to join an orchestra. So I'm dealing with talking to a whole bunch of people who don't know me before. And it's funny how I tell them I'm autistic, but it's still, There are certain people who are making jokes all the time, and I'm just staring at them blankly because it's like, I'm not sure what you've said nor how to respond. And I was smiling at, even though it's only been a couple of weeks since I've been part of this orchestra, that a lot of the people I'm interacting with will say something, say that I'm not reacting, maybe give me 10 seconds, and then just go on. And it's like, it's becoming, they're getting used to me not understanding sometimes their literal joke.
Yeah.
And you know, again, we've talked about privilege a little bit before. Like, I'm the old white male, so I don't have to mask as much as you two probably have to, which is stupid and sad, and I don't get it. I often, when I'm talking to female presenting autistics, there's that perspective of how much you have to mask, which is just another level of societal pressure.
Well, and bringing it back to medical advocacy, you know, certainly women have more difficulties being taken seriously, and that's especially true of women of color. So I think when you add in neurodivergence, when you add in that intersectionality, because there are medical textbooks. I wonder if you experienced this, Bruce, when you were going through training. There have been medical textbooks that have said things like Black people have higher pain tolerances, which is not the case, but that has led to chronic mistreatment in medical settings. You know,
I was doing it 40 years ago, so that sort of stuff. I don't remember that one, and because it was Australia, there were certain aspects of discussion of Koori physiology, which are like, what's when you used to look at the brain?
Phrenology.
It was almost aspects of phrenology in a textbook that was written in the probably early 1970s. It's just, and you know, I want to think that we were laughing about what was in the textbook, but I don't think we were. Mm-hmm.
And if you had finished medical training, you might still be practicing and you might not have had updated training in some of those domains, right? So that medical knowledge is probably still out there. Yeah. Yeah. Any thoughts, Kristen? How do you see there's change in some of these areas of understanding? I don't know how often doctors and medical personnel get to do professional development outside of their like maybe niche areas if they specialize.
In terms of understanding the needs of autistic people or?
Autistic people, any sort of marginalized group, but people of color, like combating some of the like longstanding myths/stigma about different marginalized groups.
I see it's changing slowly. And even in research, they're making, you know, real efforts to bring in people who speak different languages as participants. They're calling them, you know, patient partners sometimes as opposed to participants. So making it more of an equal playing field. So it's slowly starting to change. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, let's just say, but it's starting for sure. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah. Now, Bruce, have you been developing any? I know you develop so much professional development. Are there any plans in the works for doing that for medical fields?
There are thousands of plans. I've been actually, before I was working at Autism Canada, I was asked to develop some training systems for dentists. And we were looking at then expanding into the medical, the GP field. And certainly that's been discussed at Autism Canada a lot. But the problem we get is, as I alluded to much earlier, it's medical education is very closed. And I don't mean that in a, how else do you say that in a bad way? But it's like, doctors teach doctors, and it's been like that for hundreds of years. And getting into that is problematic And again, like, I think that the average doctor on the street, because that's what happens, I think they'd be completely fine with more professional development with marginalized communities, but it's just getting, it's getting the institutions to change. It's complex.
And that brings us kind of full circle to what Kristen, what you had said about, like, wouldn't it be great if people could be open, people who work within those institutions, to kind of, you know, show that autism is everywhere. Autistic people are in the field. Autistic people are doing great things, can have these jobs, can have extensive knowledge, you know, are just as important in the, right, in the medical field. Yeah.
And all these you know, patient partners, they should be involved in the research. I think for me, my focus is really the medical research. So definitely, like, they have to be recruited more. So if you're looking at a certain population, you have to include them, and you have to include the lived experience. And I think that's also, like, more and more researchers are including that, even in, you know, you'll see quantitative research that has an element of, like, let's bring in the patient partners to make sure we're asking the right questions, to make sure we're not, you know, offending anyone or going in a direction that's, like, totally wrong in the minds of the participants, the patients, mm-hmm. and so on. So, and also there's the issue of, like, research can be in a certain place, but it takes so much longer to reach actual practice. So I think that's the other issue, is, like, you can have some amazing finding. Yeah. And then it takes, like, 15, 20 years to actually reach practice, unfortunately. So that has to be improved too.
Yeah. But
it's like in the education field that, you know, every single teacher in Canada should read the book, The Autism Lens by Dr. Kara Diamond, because it's brilliant and wonderful.
There's a few things I would change, but it's very minor comparatively. Pre-diagnosis, post-diagnosis. But thank you, Bruce. Can we talk about your podcast for a little bit?
Sure.
We like to do something called Thing of the Day, where we present something. So in this case, I think it can be your podcast, something that we think is really cool and impressive. And you've talked a little bit about, you know, getting into the podcast, but your mission has really been about bringing out, like, talking about research, talking about how it impacts us as autistic people. Like, any other inspiration, like any other hopes that you have?
Just getting the word out about level one autism, what's called level one autism, high masking autism, the way it looks in various people, challenging myths and stereotypes, getting out the research that, you know, has autistic researchers involved. That's been, like, I'm trying to do that more and more.
Yeah.
Just sharing the lived experiences. So I get people on who just talk about where they're at in their process. Yeah. So I've even had the last one was a therapist talking about her journey and realizing she's on the spectrum,
wow,
you know, and in her 50s, and just putting the pieces together, you know, and watching that happen is amazing. And then having someone on who's been diagnosed, you know, now for several years, and what their process is. Imposter syndrome is one that comes up a lot, especially yeah, for late diagnosed. So going through that, I'll also just have episodes where I kind of lecture about a topic. And it's usually going through something that, you know, people have written in and they want to know about such and such a topic. And so I'll go in and do the research on that, which is really fun. So
I love that.
But I get so many emails from people, like, going, oh, you helped me understand myself more.
Yeah.
You helped me realize that, you know, that this might be an actual thing, and go out and find someone to do the assessment. So that makes it so worthwhile. That's why I continue to do it even with a full-time job. Like, it's my passion project. Like, I love it. And I wish I could do that and music full-time.
Yes. So. And I mean, it's probably hard to say, but do you have a favorite episode of your podcast? I know it's hard to pick. So you know, that's a terrible question. What is one episode of your podcast you particularly enjoyed?
I really got fired up when I was talking about highly sensitive person trait. So many of us go through the whole process of, like, oh, I'm an HSP, and we kind of leave it at that. And so I just kind of tore down that whole idea. And, like, that is really another way of just talking about autism. Yeah. And I really wish that Dr. Elaine Aaron would realize that and be open to that, because the resources she's created, if it was renamed, could help so many people. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just got really fired up on that one.
I've wondered about HSP. I've had a couple of people talk to me about it, and I certainly have not done the research that you will have done. And I fully understand that. It was always a little, I'm not sure that this is a thing that's separate from, you know, autism and ADHD to the same extent. And a lot of people say, oh, I'm a highly sensitive person. It's like, I'm not sure.
And so much of it overlaps with, like you said, the female autism phenotype. What I often talk about it as like an internalized, more of an internalized presentation. Yes. Because, you know, we're fairly good at spotting more externalized presentations, especially when they're boys and they're young and, you know, mm-hmm. about 8 years old and running around on their tiptoes.
But there's this whole thing online of, you know, HSPs fighting with autistic people, and it's not autism, and yes, it is. And so I think there's like a shame of being able to like label or wanting to label it autism. And so people hold on to this HSP thing so tightly. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame, because if the two communities could come together, I think there's so much potential mutual understanding. So,
yes, and strategies and support.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. Oh, I can't wait to listen to that one, because I love a good rant. B, I think you're wonderful. So
thank
putting
you.
Those together.
I think you both are wonderful as well. So I'm super excited to be doing this.
Yeah.
Just blush. Since we're all talking about how wonderful we are, like that you've raised a really, like this is a really interesting perspective I hadn't considered before about... I think it's more acceptable to be highly sensitive than autistic.
Yeah, totally.
And yes. That's why. When did that happen? Who wrote those rules? I mean, again, there's a rule book. Wow. But that's something I think I need to promote a little more or push this. Fluidity between HSP and autism. Mm-hmm. But it's also if there's nothing wrong with being a highly sensitive person, there's nothing wrong with being an autistic. Not that there's anything wrong with being autistic, but for some reason, some people have that problem.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I could have gone all along with my little HSP label. Like I was seeing an HSP therapist, like pre-diagnosis, pre-cancer, everything, right? Yeah. And it was like almost like cancer took it to like the stage where I was so burnt out that I had to figure out it's not just HSP. There's something else going on here.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't take a crisis like that to to connect the dots. And for so many people, it takes like a massive life crisis or medical crisis, right? It just shouldn't be the case. So, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. Yeah, exactly. If you listen to that episode, I'd love to hear your thoughts, because I think it's one of my longer ones.
Awesome.
I've written to Dr. Elaine Aaron and she never got back to me. But if she, like, if you watch her YouTube, read her books, which I've done, everything she says, it's like, yes, you're autistic. It's because you're autistic. Like she describes having to go into a room and like turn off the lights. I'm like, mm-hmm. That's right. So
yeah. Anyway. And like, you know, sometimes we need an autistic mentor to help us. Like Bruce, you were my autistic mentor. You were like, wait, you go when you get home, you go into a dark room every day for at least half an hour and just lay there with your cat. You don't talk to anybody. Oh yeah, ding ding ding. Like sometimes we need someone to, because we are all so limited by our own experiences. And we don't always know, like, other people do this differently than I do. This is a unique way that I have of coping, or this is a unique challenge that I face in this particular setting that maybe other people are not as sensitive to go back to that highly sensitive concept. And sometimes just having someone else like point those things out is really helpful, because we don't have that perspective always.
Right. Right.
Well, you have a problem with self-advocacy in that sense. And especially like the three of us are autistic advocates. And you know, every single day we can stand up for somebody else and we can stand, you need to be talking about this and this is what's happening and this will make your life better. And so rarely do we look at that for ourselves. And my job title is autistic advocate. And boy, can I forget the self-advocacy aspect.
It is so much easier advocating for other people. I have so much trouble doing that for myself as well. It's really interesting phenomenon to be able to have like executive functioning skills and advocacy skills for the benefit of other people.
And I am getting a training program together about this. So I don't want to give too much away, but it's, I think every advocate should do their own advocacy course once every couple of months. You know, it's like, Cara, as you and I as teachers, like I've read your book so many times and you and I've talked so much and so much of this is internalized. I still, if I'm presenting, I'll still go through your book and just go like quickly. It's a refresher. Have I missed something? Am I still making sure the focus is right and the balance, you know, balance the good mm-hmm. thing. I think that everybody needs to do their own self-advocacy course once every little while.
Well, and I think for people like Kristen, you're self-advocating all the time because your platform is very successful and you're getting out the word. So I feel like you're chronically in a self-advocacy course.
It's true, but it's, you know, same with Bruce, like in the moment, you know, I still have moments as well when I don't advocate for myself. And I think often what happens is I'll think in retrospect, like, if I could do this over again, I know what to say, but not in the moment. Right. Yeah. But it's odd. Like you were saying, if it's someone else, it's almost like I can see it more quickly. I don't know why that is.
I had,
but if it's happening to me
yesterday that like it happened and I was like, I'm going to be angry later. Like, cause my emotional processing is quite delayed sometimes.
Yes.
And so I didn't react then. And I know like later there's going to be fallout from this. And I will, like, and that's exactly what happened. Whereas if it had been a situation where I was, you know, something happened to someone else and I'm in defense of them, I can process that quickly and I can still be very logical. Right. So I can see unfairness towards other people and react immediately. But when it's to me, it's like freeze mode. Right.
That makes sense.
Delayed emotions. So mm-hmm. I can't in the moment. And it's always, oh, I should have done this later.
Definitely. Totally relate. Yeah.
Now, so yes, thing of the day is the Other Autism podcast. So go and check it out and listen to all of the episodes, not just the highly sensitive person rant, but that's top of my list. And I also wanted to ask you a little bit about your music. So when did you start creating music and what kind of music and all of that good stuff?
It's a very recent thing. I started using FL Studios to create electronic music. And it's something that I learned about through my son, actually. He's in his 20s and he started doing it with his friends. And so that's one thing, like music has always been a passion. So since I was really little, like some of the earliest memories I have, music related, playing records, things like that, dancing, watching MTV. So it's like, it's one of those things where I wanted to do it, but I just didn't know how I was going to fit it in. And so I was just like, I'm just going to take the plunge. I'm going to suck at it. But it's so fun when I'm doing it. I kind of forget everything else, go straight into flow mode. And so I would love to have more time to do it, but just unfortunately, I did play band in high school. I played the euphonium.
Oh so my gosh.
I'm not playing that anymore, but I guess called the baritone as well. So.
Okay. Oh, come on. Euphonium in electronic dance music. That's brilliant.
I should bring it in.
Yeah. We'll check up on you in a year. We'll be like, have you brought it in?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
Thanks. Yeah, it's just really fun.
I think like when we have passions, they're such deep passions, and they bring us so many benefits as autistic people. So I love that you have jumped into something new and found something that really like speaks to you.
Thank you. Yeah.
It brings you all the good stuff.
Thank you. Yeah. I think a lot of us, if we have something like that, we'll think, oh, it's self-indulgent, or, you know, I shouldn't do that because it'll take away from me doing this other thing that's more important. But if you do something purely for fun or just out of interest, I think it's always worthwhile.
Well, and it's restorative. Like it gives you more spoons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when people are really busy, and I try to take my own advice, Bruce is probably going to tell me I don't do it enough, but I certainly tell all my coaching clients, like, you have to make time to do the things that bring you joy and contentment. And everything else will be easier as a result of doing these things.
Yes, for sure. Absolutely.
There's an apocryphal saying of the Buddha that every day you should spend 15 minutes doing meditation. And if you don't have the time, you should do 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I love that.
Definitely.
Kristen, my question for the music, sorry. I have no idea how old you are, other than you've disclosed you have a 20-year-old son. So we have a thing, and that's fine. But it's like late in life diagnosis, and then late in life doing music. Why have you not done that before?
I'm 43. I don't have a problem saying.
I did. So, okay.
43. Why haven't I done it? I think I've been picking up the pieces and spending the time picking up pieces. And what that means is making up for lost time. So I got married really young. I had my son really young. School was interrupted because autism didn't know, right? So I think for a lot of autistic people, we have our schoolings interrupted. So it was this constant going back, finishing. And then for me, it was a lot of medical issues. So a lot of time poured into that. So I feel like everything's done later for me. And then also I've had issues with a challenging relationship that lasted a long time, that took a long time to get out of. And I think when you have a challenging relationship like I did, when you're not working and you're not parenting and you're not doing the other things, that's where all your energy is going. So once I left that relationship, it's like, I'm going to do what I want to do now. And finally, I have some time and some energy, some spoons, as you mentioned. So, but I would have loved to have started way sooner. So.
Actually, I always, and look, we talked about privilege before, and like, okay, it's like, this is, I'm the king of privilege in this subject, because like, I've been doing music since I was 15, and I never did anything else other than a very short period of time working as a computer programmer. And I've toured the world and played with these famous people and yeah. So of course everyone wants you doing music because it's brilliant. I do wonder though, if it wasn't the only thing you wanted to do, trying to do music seriously, trying to juggle other things is ridiculously difficult. And I think maybe this is the right time to do it. Like you're much more, your life is much more in place, much as life can ever be in place. And now is the time to start doing this. Now is the time to write your novel. Now is the time to write that play, rather than doing it at 18 and suddenly discovering you need to do this 14 hours a day and you've got no chance to do anything else.
Right. Yeah. And I have no idea where it's going to lead. Maybe nowhere, right? I have no idea. I just, at this point, it's just following what I love. I have a sound in my head and I want to get it out. That's a way. And before, I would just not have that option. So.
And I think you sent me a link to your music. Did you?
Yeah, possibly. Or it's on the link tree. I think it's linked in there. So I only have 2 songs right now. I have another one that I'm sort of working on, but.
That's amazing. 2 songs are out there. That's incredible.
Thank you. Yeah. I have so much to learn. I can hear the issues with it. I just don't know how to fix them yet, but I will learn. So,
well, you know, not everyone who listens to music is a critic. Some people just enjoy it. Bruce with more technical knowledge will probably pick up on those things.
And I've shared this before, like part of my autism is having oral hyperacuity, and which means I don't listen to music. I can't listen to music. If I'm listening to music, I'm analyzing it, or I'm trying to work out how to make it better, or I'm trying to work out what I need to get from it to do something else. Mm-hmm. So the idea of listening to music for relaxation is just like, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah. It's like going to see theater, because my undergraduate degree was in theater, but it's very hard for me to watch people perform because I can see them performing and I get analytical, and it's less enjoyable. So, but I don't have that issue with music. I love music of all types. And I really think, like, if you were in a flow state making beautiful music, that might bring out a flow state in other people too. So
I hope so.
Great gift to be able to give that back. And you give back in so many ways, your podcast and music now. This is like such an exciting point in your life.
Thank you. And you also, both of you actually, like, you're both so inspiring. So
thank you. I just do this for fun and hope some people are amused by what we do.
We certainly are. So that's important.
We always are.
All that matters.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, I
need to share that, like, for performers or people who are thinking about doing podcasts, and it's like, don't worry about the audience. If you're having fun, you'll get the audience.
But I don't even really want the audience, because again, rejection sensitive dysphoria. Like, I'm like, please don't criticize. You know, I'm like, I just want to do my thing, and if people enjoy it, they enjoy it, and otherwise, I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, that's actually another point. Bruce, you asked why I didn't do it earlier. Is I think I always have like this perfectionism thing, but it's starting, I'm having more control of it, or I know where it's coming from, so I can kind of tamp it down when I need to. And there's a point where I'm just like, this is never going to be the way I want it. So I'm just going to share it now before I think too much. And so I'm starting to be more aware of that. So
yeah.
Maybe it's my age. I don't know.
Yeah. At a certain point, we just stop caring. I'm just a few years behind you. So maybe that'll kick in.
Yeah.
The hardest thing to do when you're teaching composition, and this includes record production or classical composition, is knowing when it's finished. Mm. And it's, I still have a number of people who come to me for mentoring and talk about composition, and we'll fixate on that for years, because it's like, how do you know it's finished? You don't actually. You need to go through the process that Kristen just articulated. This is never going to be perfect. Perfect music is boring anyway. I just need to know where I'm satisfied with it at its current state, and let it go.
Exactly. And sometimes if I haven't done that, like for anything, this could be writing as well, and I'll go back and keep trying, it actually like reduces the quality. And I notice the difference if I can see the two versions. I'm like, no, actually, right.
Spiral. So you're
absolutely right. Yeah. For sure.
Well, I'm mindful of the time. So I think we should probably end here, but Kristen, I am so deeply appreciative that you made time for us today, and that we could pick your brain for a little bit on all of these amazing topics. And you have such awesome insights into things.
Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
Yeah, wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you for finally being, for you and I, we've communicated over social and email a little bit over the last 6 months to actually talk to you. Has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, and if you wanted to ask me any questions about the evacuation, I can also answer those if you wanted to.
You know what? Quickly. Yes. So, Kristen, why don't you tell us what happened? Because Bruce and I kind of know, but our listeners won't know that you were recently evacuated from your town. So, why was that?
I just have to do one thing here for work. Just make sure that they're Sorry. Okay.
That's okay.
So we were, so the McDougal Creek wildfire started in West Kelowna, and I moved here in June. So I was like hoping there would not be any wildfire season this year. It's so bad. Oh, like no. it has been, but anyway, so that started West Kelowna. My mom lives in West Kelowna. So middle of August, she came over, she was evacuated over, she came to my house, which is in Kelowna, and about, I don't know, 30 minutes to an hour later, we got evacuated from here. And it was like 15 minutes. I had to pack up as much as I could. My first priority was my cat.
Yeah.
And so I ended up forgetting my laptop. I forgot some other things I would have wanted to take. Like, it's funny, the things you think of afterwards. So, you know, like my son's artwork and some of his toys and clothes from when he was a baby, things like that. So I had 15 minutes to just pack up everything, necessities, and leave. And we could see the flames coming over the ridge behind me. And had to drive down, evacuated with a line of cars that wasn't really moving, and got pretty close to the fire. So
that was terrifying.
And then, yeah, we were out for a week. So luckily we had a place to stay in Summerland. But for a while there, I was thinking we might even have to evacuate there because the smoke was getting so bad and there were kind of fires on both sides. So yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Back now. And
Kelowna is a little piece of paradise. It's such a beautiful place. I was there as a teenager, and the mountains, the all of the beautiful orchards, everything about it is just so wonderful. So to have this happen again so quickly after you moved too, that's so stressful.
Yeah, and there was a night where the fire was. But behind across the street and then down below. And so there was one night where I was like, my things are going to get burned. Like I really believed that I was going to come home to either partially damaged place or fully.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, and it was like, my brain didn't go to the things that like my computer, not things like that. It was keepsakes. It was like the things I love that have, you know, value and sentimental purpose kind of, you know? So it's funny that your brain does all these weird things. So.
And then, that's terrible for anyone to go through, but I guess also as autistic people, we love predictability. To have to go through that much upheaval too must have been extra stressful on your nervous system.
Yes. Yes. I think I'm still feeling it.
Well, thank you so much, especially for, being able to talk to us. I know we rescheduled because it was the day before, I think, or was it the day of? I can't remember that
I'd already been evacuated. I was like, I'm on my phone. I can't do this. So yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But I feel really bad. There are a lot of people, like I said, at the beginning that lost their homes. I just can't imagine. And a lot of them have been through fires before. In 2003, there was a big fire and this one tops that. So.
Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's pretty sad.
Yeah, that is. Well, I'm so glad that you are all right, that you are back at home, and hopefully the rest of the season is winding down, wildfire season. And, we're into
better, we need rain for sure.
Definitely. Wow, what an adventure, and not a good kind of adventure.
No, I'm done with that adventure.
We'll finish now. That's it.
Yeah.
Next.
Yeah.
For pleasant sure. one now, please.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much again. And everyone, check out Kristen's podcast, and I will make sure that I link her podcast and music in the comment section. Thanks so much. Talk soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. I.